I'll see your trade war, raise you a currency manipulator, go all in on more tariffs, or, as we like to call it around here, this week in the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdoff. Friday, 9 August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A whole bunch of things to talk about this week and not nearly enough time. So here we go. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. John Harwood is with CNBC. They are both in our studios in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
We need this Friday.
Yes, we do. John, we were talking about that before the gong sounded. So look, Anna, let me start with you. We have taken a trade war, and now it has become a currency war. Is that worse, or is it all just equally bad?
It could definitely be worse. So I would say we're not in definite currency war territory yet. Oh, it was more like China fired kind of a warning shot on Monday by allowing the value of its of the renminbi to fall past 7 to the dollar, which it hasn't done for over a decade. And then the Trump administration hit back by labeling that country a currency manipulator. So this is just the very beginning stages of what could be a more prolonged currency
disagreement, shall we say?
War disagreement here. Yeah, that's right. But, you know, one that has the potential to spill over, lead to other countries trying to devalue their currencies, lead China to devalue more, which hurts U.S. exporters. So a lot of potential for pain there if it does continue.
John, continue that thought. We've got the currency disagreement, shall we say. We have the president's threats as of the end of last week to impose another 10% tariffs on $300 billion of Chinese goods on the 1st of September. Do you see any reason for hope on the horizon, or are we status quo on a downward spiral?
Well, we're heading down. I don't know if we're irrevocably in a spiral yet. The more time passes with this conflict unresolved, the more it appears that both sides are digging in. And when the administration slapped the currency manipulator label, it didn't have any immediate tangible effects. But the fact that they took that provocative step and that the step is commonly agreed not to be true. China has been holding the value of its currency as a general matter up in recent years rather than down, makes it more and more difficult for China to make concessions to the United States. And it's a risky time because this 10-year recovery has been showing some signs of fragility. And so economists worry that this conflict may tip us into recession.
Well, to that end, Anna, we now have numbers out of the UK this morning that showed their economy contracted last quarter. We have the September 1 tariffs, which would hit consumer goods. It does appear that that would be the recipe for the global weakness to come to our shores, as it were.
Right. Well, the trade war hasn't actually been having a very strong effect on the economy yet. And economists say that's because the U.S. is actually pretty insulated from trade. You know, we're a big domestic economy. But where it really is being felt is in terms of business uncertainty. And that's, you know, a really worrying sign going forward. I think I've been talking to a lot of business owners, and it's clear that a lot of people are stuck. They don't know exactly where is safe to invest. The administration has been trying to encourage companies to shift out of China, but China is a big center, and a lot of people have been looking to, you know, changing their supply chains to places like Vietnam or India, but those shifts aren't easy to make overnight, and so there's just a lot of uncertainty for businesses.
And
right
by
now.
The way, that uncertainty is not a coincidence in light of the statement by Fed Chairman Powell a few days ago that business investment is weak, which is part of the justification for his interest rate cut. Investment and manufacturing were things that were supposed to be stimulated by the Trump tax cut. His trade war is certainly undercutting any positive effect that that had.
Well, John, let's detour now for literally 30 seconds into the mind of Jay Powell, right? Is he looking at this going, come on, man, really? I just did a rate cut, right?
Of course he is doing that, and he knows that the President Trump is a huge irritant and a negative force for U.S. economic policy right now. However, he's got to deal with it and try to stay out of the politics as much as possible. And I think most people are betting that we get at least one rate cut the rest of the year, and perhaps two.
Anna, do you think that as we – I'm going to turn to politics here just for a second. Do you think that we wind up in the 2020 election cycle in the middle of a trade war, or does the president say, that's a bad idea? And I know you're not a political reporter, you're a trade specialist, but look, roll the dice for me.
Well, if I could predict the president's trade moves, I could be making a lot more money than I am now. So, I really don't think anyone has a good idea. The latest signs are that the president is pretty set on continuing down this path and that the tariffs are more likely to go into effect on September 1st. And it's really looking less and less like the two sides have an opportunity to walk back and get out of this. I mean, there haven't been very many signs of compromise soon. So I think the needle has definitely been shifting in favor of a prolonged trade war, in the 2020 election. And, you know, I think the president is also worried about making a deal that could be criticized as selling out to the Chinese. And so he knows that if he makes the deal, he could be up for some criticism from the Democrats.
John Harwood, last word to you.
Well, the president still has the option of trying to pull back and get a least common denominator deal to simply call a truce with China. That kind of deal may be more difficult for China to accept right now. But the president has really thrown his lot in with his blue-collar base in this campaign, and he may have decided that pursuing this trade war is the best way to energize that segment of the electorate.
John Harwood at CNBC, Anna Swanson from The New York Times, both of them in Washington for us today. Thank you, too. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, try though they did, traders could not get their heads above water. Details, numbers, you know the drill. One of the byproducts of all the macroeconomic agita this week, of the past couple of months really, has been that interest rates are falling. Treasury bonds, sure, we talk about that all the time. That pushes the yields on other long-term loans, though, like mortgages, down as well. The average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage hit 3.6% this week. That is a three-year low, and it's also the reason that a whole lot of people are scrambling to refinance. Refi applications on mortgages up 12% this week. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
Erin Hennessy, a PR executive in D.C., bought her first home about a year and a half ago and locked in a pretty good interest rate, just 4.25%. But today, she's in the process of refinancing.
And we're hopeful once all the paperwork is done that I will be down to 3.75%.
She figures she's going to save about $200 a month, which, because she apparently has tremendous willpower, Hennessy plans to put toward paying off the loan faster. Andy Walden follows the mortgage market at research firm Black Knight. He says the number of people who could benefit from a refi has exploded.
We currently see 9.7 million homeowners that could save 0.75% through a refinance, which is twice as many as there were in the market as little as 2 months ago.
That doesn't mean all those people should refinance. Those who aren't going to stay in their home very long might pay more in closing costs and fees than they'll save on interest. As you can imagine, it was hard to get a mortgage broker on the phone today. But Lana Jern with Uptown Mortgage in Denver gave me a few minutes.
Two-thirds of our calls that are coming in are refinances.
Jern says adding to the temptation is all the equity homeowners have been piling up as home values have risen. More of her clients have been refinancing into larger loans so they can pocket some extra cash. All this is great for lenders.
A lot of them have added many, many, many additional underwriters to handle the volume.
Jern says she'd love to have more help, but she knows the refi boom won't last forever. Interest rates go up, too. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
JCPenney, for the past couple of five-ish years, has been one long string of management shakeups and store closures interrupted by the occasional brief bright moment. Company has a stock price to prove it, too. Penny's shares have been under $5 a piece for a couple of years now, which technically makes it a penny stock. Penny stock definition starts at 500 pennies. For the past 3 weeks or so, it's been under a buck, and the New York Stock Exchange has had enough, threatening to delist Penny if the share price doesn't recover. And that could mean a new home for JCP shares, that's the ticker symbol, on what are known as the pink sheets. Marketplace's Mariel Segura has that one.
When a company gets kicked off a stock exchange, it goes to another place, the land of over-the-counter trading, which traders sometimes call the pink sheets, from back when those transactions were recorded on pink sheets of paper. Buying and selling stocks over-the-counter can be a lot more complicated. Linda Allen teaches finance at Baruch College's Zicklin School of Business, and she says typically when you buy a stock on, say, the New York Stock Exchange, a computer will make a match between you and somebody who wants to sell.
In contrast, over-the-counter trading is involving a dealer that stands between the buyer and the seller.
Also, a lot of big institutional investors aren't allowed to trade stocks over-the-counter.
So there'll be a lot fewer people who will be available to either buy or sell, and it will be harder to make a match.
Something else that happens when a company falls into the over-the-counter market, industry analysts stop paying attention to it. William Bird Thistle is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law.
And so if you lose interest from the analysts, then it becomes something of a vicious cycle where people don't know how to trade your stock and people don't know how your stock is doing. And so basically you start to fall off the face of the earth.
So while JCPenney could theoretically bounce back if it drops off the New York Stock Exchange, it would be better if that didn't happen. The company still has a chance to get its stock price back up before it gets the boot. I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
The British economy might be in a pre-Brexit swoon, as I said earlier. With Anna and John, we learned this morning gross domestic product over there in the UK actually contracted in the second quarter. But Brexit or not, the English will always have football. Soccer to us, of course. The new English Premier League season started today. All eyes on an American, as it happens. A 20-year-old phenom from Hershey, Pennsylvania, named Christian Pulisic, is making his Premier League debut. He's one of only a handful of Americans who play at the elite level overseas, in part because of the financial structure of soccer in this country. Marketplace's Andy Euler's on that one.
Millie!
40, maybe 50 kids ages 7 to 19 are working on their passing skills on this Austin, Texas soccer field. This practice is being run by Upper 90, a youth development program. What makes Upper 90 different from other soccer programs is it's free. That's a great thing for 18-year-old Samuel Osezua. He moved here from Nigeria about a year ago.
Programs like this have helped me settle in faster because since it's free, it's attractive to everybody.
In the U.S., elite competitive club soccer can be really expensive. Membership dues for a team that's affiliated with the official U.S. soccer organization, as opposed to a rec league or a school team, can cost $5,000 a year. Then there's travel. That'll run a family thousands of dollars more over the course of a season. Caitlin Swartz is founder of Upper 90. She grew up in Austin and played club soccer most of her life. She saw soccer getting more and more expensive.
And I'm really fortunate to have been born into a family that could afford that. But that's just not the reality for most people.
The fact that soccer is often unaffordable tends to limit the potential of U.S. men's soccer. Youth clubs are not feeding enough players to the national team, which wasn't even good enough to qualify for the World Cup in 2018. Here, the financial burden of developing elite young players falls to parents. Tom Ferry, executive director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute, says things work differently in Europe, where top professional teams bankroll youth players at a young age.
In Europe, the clubs are incentivized to develop those players because once they become adults, they can either contribute to the senior team or they can be sold for many millions of dollars to a rival club.
A top German league team sent the young American Christian Pulisic to Chelsea, where he'll make a whopping $73 million. Now, if Pulisic were from, say, Europe, the youth club he played on before he turned pro in Germany would be getting a fat 10% slice of that $73 million. This is called a solidarity payment. Doesn't happen in the U.S. Tom Cove is president and CEO of the Sports and Fitness Association. He says for some American clubs, that solidarity payment could mean a lot.
with that kind of money, you can kind of serve many needs, really focusing on the elite and developing that best player, but also reaching back into the community. It's a significant amount of money to reach a local club.
The governing body here, U.S. Soccer, has chosen to opt out of this system. One reason for that, professional American players worry that when a big-time club has to pay this solidarity tax, they're going to get less money. Ultimately, this means that the PA Classics, the developmental club of Pulisic's childhood, won't get a dime. Steve Klein, the head of PA Classics, declined an interview. Now, you may be asking, what about U.S. women, who just won another World Cup? Does the financial structure of U.S. soccer hold women back, too? Tom Ferry at the Aspen Institute says, not really.
In a nation of 330 million people, we just have so many more girls playing soccer. Our ability to put together a roster of 20 or 24 players who are going to be pretty good is infinitely easier than it is in a lot of other countries.
Back in Northeast Austin, Caitlin Swartz of Upper 90 isn't too worried about elite youth clubs getting money for their star players. Her organization isn't a club team, wouldn't be eligible anyway. Her goal is totally different.
Soccer should be a community thing, and you shouldn't have to have all of the time and all the money to be able to enjoy it.
Christian Pulisic makes his Premier League debut on Sunday when his new team Chelsea takes on Manchester United. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That's a burger. I know those ingredients. I can eat that.
When lunch with your coworkers gets uncomfortable. But first, sure, why not? It's Friday. Let's do the numbers. Trade tensions in the news again today. Volatility is back on Wall Street. Dow was down 280 points at one point. Down 90 at the close, a third percent, 26,287. The NASDAQ off 80 points, 1%, 79.59. The S&P 500 sagged 19 points, two-thirds of 1%, 29.18 there. For the week, and kind of a seesaw week it was, the Dow down about three-quarters of 1%, the NASDAQ off a half percent, the S&P 500 down four-tenths of 1% for the week. Talked about that refi boom, so here you go. Some players in the lending market, J.P. Morgan Chase slipped to 10%, SunTrust Bank trickled down four-tenths percent, JCPenney we told you about, more retail stocks, Macy's unzipped 4.33% today, Nordstrom declined 2.75%, bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.73%, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Uber and Lyft announced quarterly profits this week. Spoiler alert, there weren't any. And the question of whether either company is ever going to turn a profit has come into even sharper focus as the state of California considers legislation that would force the ride-sharing companies to classify their drivers as employees instead of as independent contractors. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The distinction between employee and independent contractor is an expensive one. Social Security, payroll taxes, unemployment, workers' comp, and a host of other benefits come with employee status. For companies that haven't had to deal with those costs before, that's a lot, says Stanford economist Paul Oyer.
Existential threat might be overstating it a bit.
But if California Assembly Bill 5 were signed into law, it would add an estimated $500 million in expenses a year for Uber and almost $300 million a year for Lyft.
These are companies that are so busy trying to figure out their business model as it is, and then you're throwing a big wrench into that.
Columbia business professor Leonard Sherman says there are two things Uber and Lyft need to do to approach profitability, raise prices, and contain labor expenses. If the California law adds to driver costs,
you have really attacked any possible path to profitability.
California is a crucial market for the companies, making up 17% of Uber's business and about a quarter for Lyft. It's also their home state. And whether the bill becomes law or not, it could spur copycat efforts around the country, says UC Hastings law professor Vina Dubel.
The ramifications are huge. It sends the message to other legislators, oh, that's possible.
Uber and Lyft are pursuing alternatives to human labor with driverless cars, says Susan Shaheen, an expert on transportation innovations at UC Berkeley. But
in terms of wide-scale deployment, everywhere in the United States, automation is going to take a long time.
The California bill has already passed one house of the legislature, with a final vote in the other expected this month or next. So big change could be accelerating faster than self-driving cars can keep up. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Most people, if you ask them, would tell you they're in the middle class, right? No matter how much money they make. But being in the middle class, or really anywhere on the economic spectrum, isn't just about how big your paycheck is. It's about the kind of job you have, the clothes you wear, whether you went to college or not. Those things and more play a role as well. And that can make it tricky if you are navigating from one economic layer to another. Here's Rima Kreis, the host of our podcast, This is Uncomfortable.
Wenwen Yang grew up in a household where money was tight. Her dad worked at a restaurant and her mom was a seamstress. It wasn't until she was in her 20s, working as a revenue analyst, that she officially entered the middle class. And she felt pretty lost.
Like, how do I navigate it without signaling to other people that, like, she's new here?
For Wenwen, being in the middle class isn't just about how much money she makes. It's also about the kind of social cues and references she's able to pick up on. Like, she remembers this one time she went out for lunch with her coworkers.
It was like a nice restaurant close to work. And I was like, okay, I can eat. That's a burger. I know those ingredients. I can eat that. And I was like, okay, so I'll have this burger. And and the waiter said, how do you like it cooked? And I was like, does it matter? And he says, not to me, but probably to you. And then he chuckled, and I'm still looking at him going, like, please give me a clue. What do I say? And he's like, well, do you like, is the little pink okay? I'm like, yes. Huh. And he's like, okay, that's medium. We can do that for you. I'm like, okay. And then later on, I'm like, oh, it's like ordering a steak. Okay. Because they don't ask you, you know, how do you like your burger cooked at McDonald's, right?
Wenwen says she experiences small moments like that a lot. Like the time at work where they did this icebreaker, share your favorite vacation spot, and she carefully omitted the fact that she's never left the country. Or the time she went out of her way to buy nice shoes, only to overhear her coworkers later talk about how that style is too casual for the office. It's a really delicate balancing act. She doesn't want to lie about her upbringing, but she's also not eager to share details.
Yeah, what do you think you're afraid of exactly?
Judgment. Judgment that, like, or them believing something that, you know, is not true about me. That, like, they might have an image of what poverty looks like.
You know, one of the fears is that lack of cultural knowledge is actually a proxy for your actual knowledge of the world.
That's Michael Krauss, a social psychologist at Yale. He says it makes sense that Wenwen would be nervous about sharing her background.
People are very concerned about seeming like, because they don't have the cultural fit, that they are going to be seen as lower in competence. And then that's, in fact, what ends up happening, right? If you lack the fit, people think of you as less competent, less worthy.
Wait, really? So research shows that people, like, your fears are valid?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, so
that's
true.
That's not what I'd want to hear. Okay.
Michael has spent his career researching inequality, and more specifically, the ways we evaluate each other and ourselves based on class.
Any behavior that's visible is going to be probably, have a class signature as part of it.
In one of his studies, people could accurately guess a stranger's social status just by scrolling through their Facebook photos. In another study, it took just pronouncing 7 words that didn't even need to be arranged in a full sentence.
It's not something that you would have to make inferences about over a period of weeks, right? It's happening online, right during a job interview, right away.
It's kind of scary.
Yes.
Even though Wenwen has technically been in the middle class for years now, she says she still feels like a bit of an outsider.
I'm probably always going to be like an anthropologist wherever I am, being like, well, this is a new thing and learning about it. But it's definitely assembling pieces that, becoming more and more middle class.
She says it's a process. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
You can download Rima's new podcast. It's called This is Uncomfortable, wherever you choose to get your podcasts. Final note on the way out today. If you're a Chase Bank credit card customer in Canada, do we have some good news for you? The company, which is a division of JPMorgan Chase, decided last year to get out of the Canadian market and so said it was going to close all the credit card accounts north of the border. Of course, you still had to make payments until yesterday. Chase says it's forgiving all the Canadian credit card debt it's owed, won't say how much money that is or how many customers are off the hook. But if that could be you, check your statement, eh? All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial's down 90 points on this Friday, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ down 80 points, that's about 1%. S&P 500 lost 19 points, about two-thirds of a percent there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.